Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Seth Graham Smith stumbled on a surprise bestseller when he dropped Ninjas and Brain Eaters into Jane Austen in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. The book sold a million copies and spawned a crazy season of literary monster mashups, sea monsters, werewolves, androids, and more, tucked into old texts by Jane Austen, Tolstoy, H.G. Wells, Mark Twain, readers snapping them up. Graham Smith's new book imagines Abraham Lincoln as a great leader who ends slavery and saves the Union from vampires. This hour On Point, the strange appeal of monster mashups. You can join the conversation. Are you one of the million who bought into Austen plus Zombies? Why? What's the appeal? And what about Honest Abe, Vampire Slayer? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a clip from the book trailer for Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Longtime Lincoln impersonator Michael Krebs reads from Lincoln's fictional secret diaries as he stews on the Civil War.
There is a war coming. It shall not be a war of man, but it is man who shall spill his blood fighting it. For it concerns his very right to be free, and I, of all men, must win it.
Okay, and here's the bit you might not have imagined.
I've been a slave to vampires for 30 years.
Oh, jeez. Joining me now from Culver City, California, Seth Graham Smith, author of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that spent 10 months on the New York Times bestseller list. His new book out today is Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Seth Graham Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Austin, Texas, we're joined by Elizabeth Richmond Garza, professor of English and director of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Texas at Austin. She teaches a very popular course called The Uncanny, which explores how the bizarre and unexpected and undead feature in the art and literature of the past century. Elizabeth Richmond Garza, great to have you with us as well.
Hello, it's wonderful to be here.
Now, later in this hour, we will hear from no less than Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin on what Abraham Lincoln might have thought of all this. Seth Graham Smith, first to you, I guess that million sales tell us everything we need to know about why we've got this book sitting here. The last one really sold.
Well, the last one really sold. I mean, you know, I think of myself as the luckiest freelancer in the world. You know, Lev Grossman wrote a piece in Time that sort of pointed that out. I got a call from my editor at Quirk Books in Philadelphia, Jason Rakulak, and he had this title, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he couldn't get this title out of his head, and he asked me, what do I think? And I was just, I don't know why. I guess it's the same reaction a lot of people ended up having to the book, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so I began to outline what the book might look like, and I began to write sample chapters, and before I knew it, we had a book, you know, flying up the charts, and people couldn't seem to get enough of it. So I don't know. The short answer is I don't know what people love about these books. I have a guess, which is that, you know, it lets us experience these tried and true, these familiar stories almost for the first time again. It lets them experience them anew. So you know, as for the marriage of brain-eating zombies and Jane Austen, or the marriage of vampires and Abraham Lincoln, you know, for me, the mashups that are out there, the ones that really work, are the ones that aren't just arbitrary pairings of two completely different things. They're the ones who sort of have a that work on a second level, a thematic level. For Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that thematic level was, you know, you have these uptight Regency era aristocrats who wouldn't dare say anything impolite in mixed company. And they're just so uptight and reserved. And the fact is that their country in my version is overrun with what they call unmentionables. And despite the fact that their country is falling down around them and being eaten alive by zombies, they still cling to this politeness, which, you know, I just found very funny in writing the book. And I think a lot of people found funny in reading it.
We'll talk about the resonance in in the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. You found one there as well, and we will pick it up. But Professor Richmond Garza, I mean, this looks like precisely your meat in a way. Your concentration's been on Orientalism, the Gothic, Cleopatra, Oscar Wilde, and European drama. You teach the uncanny. But explain to us. I mean, I'm looking at a list a page long here of, you know, sort of knockoffs of Pride and Prejudice and zombies. Everybody's piling into the pool. What do you think is so apparently very appealing about this kind of mashup?
Well, I think one of the things that's so exciting about Seth Graham Smith's first novel, but also this second one, is the fact that it actually gives you this kind of double vision. It really is uncanny. Simultaneously, he does a superb job of recreating Jane Austen's elegant Regency prose, and he gives us this completely unexpected but entirely appropriate double text. And he does exactly the same thing in the Abraham Lincoln as well. We all know what these wonderful biographies of important presidents should look like. We have a sense of their autobiography and also of the literary biography that somebody in the modern time might write about them. And we get this pleasure of watching the gap and the disjunction between the two. To my mind, additionally, by choosing the zombie, by choosing the vampire, and I'm very interested in vampires, he taps into all kinds of things that are manifestly fascinating to us in this uneasy, multicultural, international age that we live in today.
So,
Elizabeth makes me sound like a smart guy.
I think you are.
Oh, thank you.
You must be brilliant.
You're the first.
Seth, give us a little bit of the story then. We're waiting here. Last time with the Jane Austen, did you actually use the text of Pride and Prejudice and weave your bit in?
That's what I did. This time it was from the ground up. Like you said, last time I took the original Pride and Prejudice and sort of painted between the lines, painted over it, and weaved a new story between the lines and tried, like Elizabeth said, to mimic the style of Jane Austen as closely as I could, and especially in these absurd, over the top, you know, the Bennett sisters battling kung fu style against hordes of the undead. With Lincoln, I actually got the idea for Lincoln by walking into a bunch of bookstores a couple of years ago. I like to hang out there, see what people are reading, see what's on the tables, and as we were leading up to the bicentennial of Lincoln's birth a couple of years ago, it seemed like there was a new Lincoln book coming out every week.
Yes, it did.
And this was also, fortunately, the time that the Twilight phenomenon was blowing up. So inevitably, next to that Lincoln table, you would have a vampire table.
This is the teen super hit of vampire stories that have been an ongoing series.
Exactly. And so it seemed like there were new Lincoln and new vampire books added to those tables every week. And it was just what I call that, you know, chocolate and peanut butter moment. What if these two great tastes taste even better together, you know? And it got me thinking. And lo and behold, just as I had the same feeling when I first read the original manuscript of Pride and Prejudice, is I couldn't believe how many opportunities there were for zombies in that book. And when I read the life story of Abraham Lincoln, including Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, I couldn't believe how many opportunities there were to weave vampires into them. So that was the genesis of it.
We'll hear what she herself has to say about that in a few minutes. Give us a sense of the story that you're weaving in. This is all yours this time, no borrowed text. The intrepid Seth Graham Smith in your story finds a secret diary of Lincoln. We come to understand that his mother was killed by vampires, others that he cares about a great deal. He becomes enemy for life. But there's also a backstory to the entire Civil War. The Confederacy, in your retelling of history, has aligned itself with bad vampires who are killing and eating and drinking the blood of slaves.
Right. In the book, the slavery is in the book a very real and pre-existing American evil. But my premise is that evil is something that draws a lot of European vampires to come to America, because here in the United States, because of the evils of slavery, they can feed without fear of reprisal. They are in league with Southern slave owners, and Abraham Lincoln has experienced his own miseries at the hands of vampires, especially the loss of his mother when he was a boy. and he vows to rid America of vampires. And, you know, the Southern vampires vow to enslave all of mankind, not just the existing slaves. And so, you know, the inevitable conflict plays out.
So this is the kind of unknown, unspoken reason to actually go to war.
This is the real history, Tom. This is the actual secret history.
I mean, it seems absurd even to talk about. But you've got, there's one vampire who allies himself with the future president, Henry, who he's a so-called good vampire. And he says to Lincoln, there's a war coming. It's a conflict that began long before there was an America, a conflict between two groups of vampires, those who seek to coexist with man, and those who would see all of mankind in chains, bred, raised, and corralled as cattle. Ooh, shiver me timbers. Now we're all scared.
We're in deep trouble, yeah. And then along comes Lincoln, the greatest vampire hunter of his age, and he saves us all.
Elizabeth Richmond Gardner, is this just exploitation of a willing and ready market? Is this necessary fun? Is this the same thing that people were doing, I don't know, in one way or another, you know, in the Gothic era, a century and more ago?
Well, I think one of the things that's great about Seth's book actually is that it is completely its own standalone piece, but it actually taps into things that have always been why there's a ready market for vampire stories. The Southern plantation owners who own their slaves are really a kind of modern variant and an American variant from the later 19th century of where the vampire story comes from originally. If aristocrats predate on poor unsuspecting villagers in Transylvania in the original legends and in the 19th century versions of it, to translate this into the American South and the slave system is an inspired kind of adaptation. The idea that somebody has to be charismatic and powerful often creates a kind of double image of the vampire. All these doubles are what's so fun about it. The real, the normal, the ordinary, the familiar, and then the uncanny next to it. A number of writers, there's actually a wonderful series called Night Watch in Russia, have realized that the power of the vampire, his capacity to survive, is simultaneously attractive and terrifying. So we need good and bad, and we need these freedoms to be fought for.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Seth Graham Smith, author of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, about his latest monster mashup out today, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and the strange appeal of mixing monsters and classic. Seth Graham Smith joins us from Los Angeles. You can read an excerpt of his new book at our website, onpointradio.org. We're also joined today, and very happy to be so, from Austin, Texas, by Elizabeth Richmond Garza. She teaches the very popular course, The Uncanny, at the University of Texas, Austin. And we will go to callers in just a minute. But Seth, I wish you'd read just a bit for us to get a sense of how you go about this. There's a part early on in Abe Lincoln's childhood. It's overshadowed by a one-armed Kentucky loan shark in your telling named Jack Barks, who in the book is responsible for young Lincoln's mother's death. He ultimately drives a stake through Bart's heart and vows to rid America of all vampires. Could you read for us, Seth?
Sure. Abe Lincoln was 16 years old that summer, and his resolution to kill every vampire in America was off to an inauspicious start. His father's fears had proved needless. No vampires ever came to avenge Jack Bartz. In fact, in the 4 years since he'd staked Bartz, Abe hadn't so much as seen another vampire, though not for lack of trying. He'd spent countless nights chasing distant screams on the wind and keeping watch over freshly dug graves, just in case, as folklore suggested, a vampire came to feast on the corpse. But with nothing more than old books and old myths to guide him, and his father unwilling to help, Abe spent those 4 years in a constant state of frustration. There was little to do but keep up with his training. He'd reached his full height of 6'4" every square centimeter of him lean muscle. He could out-wrestle and outrun most men twice his age. He could bury the head of an axe in a tree from over 30 yards. He could pull a plow every bit as fast as a draft horse and lift 250-pound log clean over his head. What he couldn't do was sew. After spending weeks trying to fashion himself a long hunting coat, only to see it fall to pieces after one or two wearings, he'd broken down and paid a seamstress to do the job. He hadn't asked his stepmother, for fear of raising the obvious question of what he needed such a coat for. The long black coat was lined with thick material over his chest and stomach, and inside pockets to store all manners of knives, cloves of garlic, and a flask of holy water, which he'd blessed himself. He wore his quiver of stakes on his back and a thick leather collar. one that he'd commissioned from an Elizabethtown tanner, around his neck.
Seth Graham Smith reading from his new book, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and suddenly the visual that we all have of long, tall Abe Lincoln in that long black coat is explained by the arsenal, starting with a big axe right down to stakes and thick leather collar that he uses to go after vampires. I'm tumbling in this world, but trying to figure it out, and there are so many now who've come in behind Seth Graham Smith. Let's go to our listeners, Pete in Beverly, Massachusetts. Pete, you're on the air.
I haven't read this, but it sounds interesting. But it's curious to me, the vampires and the phenomenon that's going on now with Twilight, et cetera. Somebody must have realized it's a metaphor for capitalism. We have real vampires like Bush, Cheney, et al., and the huge economic dislocations that we're suffering through now, and to displace it all onto these weird, albeit, powerful creatures, to me is it's a metaphor for the kinds of vampiristic forces that are bleeding our treasure and ourselves in our times. You have Mary Shelley, you have the Romantics, you have Blake's Satanic Mills coming out of these similar dislocations as the vampire, the original vampire genre in the 19th century. Michael Lessie documents how American rural farmland was literally driven insane by the economic dislocations of the 19th century when the vampires were first created as a genre, again contemporary with Romanticism. But anybody ever thought to put it in a more a political direction rather than as in a fantastic direction?
Wow, Pete, you're biting right in here. Elizabeth, I would put Pete right in the front row of your class, but the vampiristic forces here, what about it, Elizabeth? You see the sort of parallel dynamics that Pete's spotting?
Oh, I think absolutely so. I should be in the front row of Pete's class, I think. The obvious place to start with this to say is that one of the most striking cases of the metaphor of the vampire is, of course, in Karl Marx's own writings. So from the very beginning, there's been a sense that there are people who live off others, who are parasites, who have not earned, who do not deserve, who in fact take from others what is authentically theirs. And so whether you want to connect this back to the first literary vampire in English, who was George Gordon Lord Byron's text from the 18-teens, or whether you want to look at the very contemporary ones, it seems to me we are interested in these super predators, appalled by them, but fascinated by them. And what I think Seth Graham Smith does so well here, using the style of the 19th century, is, and he makes it a first-person narrative. We get the eye of Abe Lincoln telling us what it's like to be in this life-and-death battle, which could very much be understood as an economic one.
Seth, when you at one point you send this Abe Lincoln south, he ends up face to face with Jefferson Davis, his long black coat loaded with that arsenal. But they get into a kind of dialectic here where Jefferson Davis is saying, Mr. Lincoln, you know, vampires are superior to man, just as man, the white man, superior to the Negro, the natural order of things. He's trying to persuade him of all this, and Abe responds, "And when the blood of Negroes is no longer sufficient, when the undesirables of our race have been exhausted, tell me, Mr. Davis, who then shall your kings feed upon?" He's definitely bringing in a kind of political hierarchy here, racial, you name it.
Well, the book's definitely political in that sense, in the way that Abe was a very political man, obviously. I tried to stay as true to his living ideals, his actual personality as possible, and to paint him in a respectful light, even though I had him decapitating vampires. But as Elizabeth was saying, you know, something that I was very conscious of doing is tying the idea of slaveholding and vampirism together in the book, because as Elizabeth said, it's, you know, vampires steal the essence of who a person is. They take their blood, they take their lives from them, their possibilities. And, you know, to me, that was a very clear there was a very clear correlation between that and what slave owners and overseers did in the 1800s.
I get it, but respectful, I just don't know. Kind of crazy. We'll ask Doris Kearns Goodwin in a moment what she makes of it. Laura in Sherburne, Massachusetts. What do you think, Laura?
Hi. I have not had the pleasure of reading the book, and I look forward to the opportunity. I am a fan of vampires, and I'm a fan of Abraham Lincoln. I was wondering if there's any...
You're the ideal customer then, Laura, to reduce it to that
exactly.
Number.
It's perfect. I was wondering if there's any concern or negative kind of feedback regarding people view Abraham Lincoln as, you know, the freer of slaves in the, out of the goodness of his heart, or recognizing the injustice of slavery. And Seth's attribution of the freeing of slaves to towards vengeance for his mother's death. So in other words, he didn't just do it out of the kindness of his heart or recognizing the injustice, but to avenge his mother.
Laura, we'll ask, but what about on the, I don't know, trivialization front? Do you worry this trivializes quite an important moment in American history and people's lives within that moment? Are you there, Laura?
Yes, I'm sorry. No, I don't. I mean, it's all pleasure. Reading is just an escape, isn't it? I mean, we seek it for many reasons. So, you know, if we can escape and learn about Abraham Lincoln at the same time, all the better.
Maybe you're right. We'll put it to Seth. Here's a comment from a listener on Facebook. Dawn Marie says, "I absolutely hate Jane Austen and find anything she writes boring. I loved Zombies." That is your version of Pride and Prejudice, Seth, because it helped me see the satire that she was trying to create, and I was able to finish the book. On the other hand, Mr. Graham Smith, here's Publishers Weekly calling Abraham Lincoln Vampire Killer grandiose and gratuitous. Says the author's decision to reduce slavery to a mere contrivance of the vampires is unfortunate, bordering on repellent, sir.
Repellent.
Repellent.
Yes. Well, I've been called worse, so, you know, repellent isn't that bad. But as to the caller's point, I was from the get-go extremely concerned with painting Abraham Lincoln in a positive light. I mean, having gone through this with some of the more rabid Jane Austen fans who saw any tampering with Pride and Prejudice as sacrilegious. By the way, in all fairness, the vast majority of self-proclaimed Austenites have embraced the book and seem to take it in good fun. But I was very sensitive about this is a guy who this Lincoln is a man who's on Mount Rushmore. He's on the $5 bill. He's perhaps the greatest American who's ever lived. And, you know, I will say the more I researched his actual life preparing to write the book, the more my respect for him grew, because this is a man who suffered the trials of Job in his life. He buried two sons. He buried his first love. He buried his older sister. He buried his mother. He suffered from bouts of melancholy. He pulled himself up from having absolutely no money and no privilege and no education and reached the highest office in the land with nothing more than his own ambition and his own genius to get him there. And then, oh, by the way, he saved our country from self-destruction. So I have an enormous respect for the real Lincoln. And when people read the book, I think that will come through, because I really did try to adhere to his real-life ideals and his personality, even though I was giving them this absurd scope. And it's clear also in the book that Abe is repulsed by slavery even before he learns about its connection to vampires. So I don't, you know, just as sensitive about not wanting to displease Jane Austen's many millions of fans, I was also even more sensitive about not wanting to disrespect the legacy of the real Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, to the people that say, well, you know, this is all, you know, sort of disrespectful and ridiculous. I mean, like the caller said, I think it's about pleasure reading. It's about immersing yourself in something and finding a new way into a story. And, you know, I could paint a mustache on the Mona Lisa, but in no way would that diminish one iota the greatness of the original work. So I don't flatter myself to think that anything I could do would diminish the legacy of Jane Austen or diminish the legacy of Abraham Lincoln.
Professor, what about the trivialization claim here, the mustache on the Mona Lisa? There's so many knockoffs now. We've got Queen Victoria Demon Hunter coming out, Android Karenina, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and Zombie Jim. Is this just modern frippery? Is this a sign that we're in a trivial age? Or how do you see it?
Well, obviously, since I work on Oscar Wilde, the word trivial is not a negative one. What I think is crucial is exactly what Seth has just said. He actually has written two books here that are about how much he admires Jane Austen and Abraham Lincoln. They're not lampoons that are disrespectful. They in no way belittle the seriousness of the slave trade and the seriousness of the owning of human beings, quite the reverse. They really movingly, actually, and they're very direct passages, take up the matter of mortality, of children, of people dying of tuberculosis, including even Edgar Allan Poe in the middle of the novel. And so what's amazing, and why I think this is trivial in a good sense, is that it invites us, all Gothic texts are flamboyant and outrageous, mm-hmm. all of them are trivial, into looking at these, if you like, sacred texts, in a sense, national myths, the greatest ever novel written in the English language by at least the British, invite us into those in this new and delightful way, precisely to get us to the core issues that concerned Lincoln back in the 1850s and 1860s, and maybe nowadays, as your first caller was suggesting, in terms of race, economics, senses of love and loss, are as pressing in 2010 as they were a little while ago.
John, Chesapeake, Virginia, you're on the air, John.
Yes, I just wanted to say how big of a fan of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies I was, and how much I'm looking forward to getting a chance to read Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Killer. And I just think it's really interesting. The original book is, had a lot of my friends go back now and read actual Jane Austen stuff, the original Pride and Prejudice, things like that. I was just curious if that was part of your intention in writing these books.
Well, when I first set out to write Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, no, it wasn't my intention. To be honest with you, I was just obsessed with the idea, and I was concerned with just that book. But like you said, and as one of the other callers mentioned, you know, I've heard from so many people, men, women, seventh graders who've written me letters who said, you know, I never would have picked up a Jane Austen book for the life of me, but this got me to read Pride and Prejudice, and because I made it all the way through and enjoyed it and realized that so much of the original book is in there, they have been inspired to read other works by Jane Austen. So not that this is my grandiose, you know, plan to sort of turn people on to the real Lincoln, but I think that that's inevitable in some cases. I hope that reading Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter will turn people on to learn more about the real extraordinary life because of Lincoln, because Lincoln's life certainly didn't need vampires to make it incredible. You know, I hope they'll go mm-hmm. and read Doris's book.
Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Tyree, you're on the air, Tyree.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an English professor, but I'm calling now just as a fan. Read Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies. I'm looking forward to the Lincoln book. But my question is, if the author is planning on sticking with the Romantic Victorian era, or is he going to branch out into other genres of literature for future projects?
Seth.
Well, I think that you know, I'm outlining a book now, and it's very early on. But I think for me, the next challenge I want to pose to myself is to write something completely original, something that doesn't rely on a pre-existing story. You know, first there was Pride and Prejudice, which was a pre-existing book. Then there was Abraham Lincoln, which was a pre-existing life. I think next, you know, for many reasons, I want to write something wholly original, a story that stands on its own. So that's where I'm at in terms of the next book.
And off you go. Into what era?
Well, you know, I think
Victorian.
No matter what, I think it's going to have a sort of a Gothic feel to it. But maybe in the modern day, definitely dealing with the supernatural, and definitely edgy and a little gory, but maybe not based on a story or an institution that we're so familiar with.
Elizabeth, is the Gothic a one-way street for writers? Once they get into it, do they ever come out?
Well, I think always people who move into the Gothic are remembered for it. I don't know that it has to be a one-way street. I also think that the Gothic can be, as Seth was just suggesting, a kind of state of mind, not merely a period. Of course, there are times when it's especially popular, the 19th century being one of those. I actually think our current time is one like that as well, with all of the concerns about globalization and modernity and anxiety and alienation. There's a kind of Gothic that wouldn't require any long petticoats or any frock coats or anything like that at all. So, if you like, there's a kind of capital G Gothic, mm-hmm. which is about giving us that strange spin, that unexpected riff on reality. Maybe that is a one-way street. Seth sounds as though he might always be doing that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Seth Graham Smith, author of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, about his latest monster mashup out today, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Elizabeth Richmond Garza joins us as well from the University of Texas at Austin, professor of English there, teaches a course called The Uncanny on the Bizarre and Unexpected in Art, Music, Literature, Film from the Last Century, and there is a lot of it. Seth joins us from L.A., Elizabeth from Austin, Texas, and we are delighted right now to have with us, for just a few minutes, from Boca Raton, Florida, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and Lincoln biographer, author of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, good enough to grace us with her presence around this gothic retelling today. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tom. I'm always glad to be with you.
I don't know if it's the silly season or if you find it interesting, but take it. We'll leave you aside for just a second and try and tap your expertise. We know Abe Lincoln had a famously good sense of humor. Do you think Honest Abe would have understood what the heck was going on here with this kind of telling?
Well, I think there's no doubt that Lincoln loved good stories, and to the extent that this is a good story and is fun to read, I think he'd have fun with it. I mean, that's the great thing we don't often realize about Lincoln, is what a gifted storyteller he was and how much humor mattered to sort of battle with the melancholy that he suffered with most of his life. So to the extent that this gets more people to read about him and to think about him as a hero, even if it's a hero in a very different way, I think he'd be just fine.
Now, between you and Gore Vidal and a lot of others, I have this sense of Abe Lincoln as not only a joke teller and a Cracker Barrel story spinner, but also as someone who lived in a time when the gothic and the macabre were quite a fascination and had his own fascinations there.
You know, the interesting thing, I think, about what Seth has done is that he bases most of the story on the impact that his mother's death had on Lincoln when Lincoln was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And while I do not know about the vampire part or think about that,
right,
there's no doubt that that experience with his mother's death and then his sister's death and then Anne Rutledge's death had a lasting effect on his life. In my understanding, what it was is that when his mother died, she said to him, "Abraham, I'm going away from you now, and I shall never return," which made him haunted by the thought that when we die, that is the end of us. And only did he find consolation in the thought that if he could accomplish something really worthy in his life, then he could be remembered and the death would not go unremarked. So in an interesting way,
mm-hmm,
that's a key lodestar element in my understanding of Abraham Lincoln. Now, Seth has taken it to an alternative universe,
right,
but
right,
he's starting at the right point.
And there, of course, Lincoln sits in the Lincoln Memorial today. What about the good versus evil battle that's implicit in every vampire zombie tale, you name it? I mean, again, it sounds kind of nutty, but did Abraham Lincoln himself see the conflicts that he was in the middle of as a good versus evil drama?
No, you know, that's a really interesting question, because I think what made Lincoln special is, unlike the other fellow anti-slavery orators who did see it as good versus evil and who argued that the Southerners were evil, unchristian men, the cause of all misery in the land, Lincoln's great quality was empathy, trying to understand the other side. So he would argue if the South still had no longer had slavery, they would not introduce it. If we in the North still had it, we would not know how to end it instantly. So he was always trying to understand both sides of an issue. So I'm not so sure he thought in terms of good and evil, in the way in which I suspect if you are a vampire hunter, you have to think in terms of good and evil.
Seth Graham Smith, you're in the presence of the great goddess of Lincoln history. What do you say, sir?
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Don't be crazy. I don't mean that as a criticism. That's
no.
Thinking about our Abe.
Right, right.
No, I know. I know. I mean, I would say that the one thing that I hope when Doris reads the book, I hope that she gets this sense, and like I said before, I hope that people who read the book do get the sense of how much I do respect the real man. I think it's hard after reading Doris's book, after reading anything about our Abe's real
mm-hmm
life, not to respect what he went through and what he accomplished. So I don't know what to do other than sit here and babble and geek out about the fact that Doris Kearns Goodwin knows who I am. So I'm going to shut up now and let her talk some more.
Did Lincoln read
Seth, you know, I think I did actually read the book in these last couple of days and enjoyed it thoroughly. And
thank you
very
much.
What you have been able to do is, where you're dealing with real history, it's there. And I love the fact that Seward is a vampire hunter. He's my favorite character other than Lincoln.
Right.
And the fact that he becomes a partner with Lincoln in the vampire hunting is exactly right. And the fact that Chase doesn't believe in vampires is exactly right. So
all of those personality traits stolen from your book, by the way.
That's quite a right.
Okay.
Team of Rivals informing the vampire world. What about Lincoln himself, Doris? Did he read popular entertainments of his time, or did he just, I don't know, read Marcus Aurelius?
Well, you know, he didn't have much access early on to books. He had to scour the countryside to find whatever he could. So it was the Bible and Shakespeare, and eventually his partner, his law partner, brought more books in. He was never a big novel reader. He preferred mostly drama, and particularly Shakespeare, which he had actually memorized huge chunks of before he died.
So we don't know if it would have made his nightstand or not.
Well, he loved humorous things. He loved stories. And he loved going and reading them to Hay and Nicolay when he couldn't sleep at night. He would read these funny little stories. So I can imagine him staying up at night and being able to read out loud some of the funnier parts of this vampire story. This is a whole new world for me, vampires. I knew nothing about it. So to be able to connect Abraham Lincoln to the vampire world, if it brings more people who love vampires to love Abraham Lincoln, then a good thing is done.
Well, between Seth and you, maybe we can just imagine him chuckling or, I don't know, or smacking his forehead in dismay. I'm not sure. Doris Kurtz Goodwin, you are a very good sport to grace us with your presence for a few minutes here today. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted to be with you. You take care, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Let's go to Fort Mill, South Carolina, and Vesta. Vesta, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you all?
Very well. What do you see?
If I'd seen this title at the bookstore, I would look at disdain at the author. This interview has changed my mind about a lot of things. I am not a vampire person. I thought it was just a distortion and not worthy of even thought. But I'm listening to this interview, and I sense the good versus evil. I sense God versus Satan. And even though it's not popular to apply religion, I'm sensing a spiritual overlay. And I'm asking the author, is that the case?
Well, it's not entirely the case, but there is a spiritual element to the book in the sense that Abe struggled with his religious beliefs and his spirituality for most of his life. And there are numerous passages in the book where Abe, in his journals, appeals to God for advice, begs God to change something, or enrages at God for doing something that he sees as unjust or unfair. So, you know, while it's not my intention to, you know, to write a religious book, because I'm dealing with Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, dealt with religion and spirituality throughout his whole life in many ways, I guess it's inevitable that gets in there.
We don't want to leave it all noble. Describe for us some of the, there's some real down and dirty battles here. Abe wields that axe and his stakes and all the rest. Give us a sense of how Abe Lincoln, vampire slayer, goes after a vampire, Seth.
Well, without pity, without remorse, he certainly does hate vampires, especially as a young man when he's more emotional. His weapon of choice, as you might expect, is his trusty axe.
That rail-splitting axe we've all seen.
Exactly. And, you know, he was legendary in his real life. I mean, he was 6'4" and, you know, strong as an ox. And there are all these stories about what a great wrestler he was and how strong and what a great rail splitter he was. And I just, you know, take that as usual to an extreme and make him a gifted axe thrower and knife wielder and stake stabber. And, you know, and he trains himself to be quite the vampire hunter in this book.
And so many deaths in this life, and you tie them back to vampires. There's a New Salem section in here in real history. You've got my attention there. He actually lived with my great-great, I don't know what, Aunt Polly Cameron back in the day for a while there in New Salem.
And no, her, she was a
and
good
family.
Woman, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, not a vampire.
But
don't
Anne
worry.
Rutledge, a vampire connection in your telling?
Yeah, well, you know, Anne Rutledge amongst Lincoln scholars is sort of a disputed subject. I mean, some people go so far as to say she didn't exist, and some people say that she wasn't Lincoln's first love. I go with the fact that she was Lincoln's first love. And yeah, just like his mother, it's a vampire, a jealous vampire who takes Anne from Abe. And that, of course, feels like losing his mother all over again. And then, you know, Abe has his rage is renewed.
Loved and lost. Sean in Seekonk, Massachusetts. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering how the author would compare his books to other novels by other writers that take a historical perspective and change things up, like Harry Turtledove.
Turtledove. I don't know it. Tell us, Seth or Sean.
I don't know specifically Harry Turtledove's book, but for me, the comparison would be, you know, Gregory Maguire, who, you know, has found a very interesting way into existing stories. And, you know, with books like Wicked, you know, he tells, you know, the Wizard of Oz from a different perspective. And to me, that's really what it's all about. You know, Lincoln was born of a moment of seeing, you know, two book tables at a lot of bookstores and realizing that people loved vampires and loved Lincoln. And I wanted to know why they did. And that's what got me going on this. But, you know, the more I think about it, the more it's just, you know, trying to tell a familiar story, one we all know in our DNA, basically, the story of Lincoln, Pride and Prejudice, the story of the Wizard of Oz, in a new way, something that allows us to discover them again almost for the first time.
Evelyn in Nashville. You're on the air, Evelyn.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Seth, you just stole my comment about Gregory Maguire.
Whoops.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's pretend I never said it. Let's pretend I never said it. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just so excited. I wanted to let you know I'm putting every one of your books on my Amazon to buy list, and the reason is because, you know, hearing you talk about your creative reimagining of these two, not with Lincoln and the vampires, but Pride and Prejudice, just making us think about things that we've known about for so long in a different way, and that made me think of Maguire, who is a favorite author of mine, and I thought, well, dude, I've got to check out Seth. So I'm excited to read your stuff.
Evelyn, thanks for your call. And another Chris in Riverside, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just struck. I thought I'd chime in as a libertarian taxpayer that discussion of between Lincoln and Douglas, when the blood of Negroes runs out, who then? And I thought Margaret Thatcher's wonderful saying about socialism, that the trouble with socialism is sooner or later you run out of other people's money. And I just thought I'd throw that in for a little political balance here.
Okay, Chris. Thank you. So, Seth, you're right in the middle of very contemporary politics there. You're enlisted the Tea Party or libertarians anyway.
I can't say that the Thatcher connection was intentional, but I'm glad it's there.
And from Colchester, Connecticut, Scott, you're on the air.
Really great to talk to you. I got your book for Christmas, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that is, and had one of those moments staring at it where I'm like, oh, this can't be serious. Well, and I was happy to find out that it wasn't. But the point I guess is I got beyond my original take on, well, this is just going to be nonsense, and realized really quickly that you were kind of calling into question the sensibilities of the period, women as these retiring and shy creatures, and suddenly they're out killing zombies and learning ninja skills. And it was the whole juxtaposition that made me think about things in a whole different way. And is that really your key intent behind a lot of these books that you're doing?
Well, I think that the mashups, there's so many mashups out there now after Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and, you know, I'm sure I haven't had a chance to read virtually any of them. I'm sure some of them are very good. I'm sure some of them aren't good. But I think, you know, the ones that I want to write, the ones that I believe will be the best ones, are the ones that don't just, that aren't just arbitrary pairings of two things, the ones that work on a deeper level. And, you know, that's why I think Pride and Prejudice and Zombies works for so many people, because it is consistent with the themes of the original book. And that's why I hope that Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter also works on more than one level, because, you know, as we've been discussing, you know, there are all sorts of parallels between slavery and vampirism, mm-hmm. and Abe's real life and Abe's vampire hunting life.
Mm-hmm. One more call, and I'm coming to you, Elizabeth. Helen in Charleston, South Carolina. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make the quick comment that the ancient Romans took the Greek mythology and stories, and they revised it and tweaked it and made it more entertaining. And I get the feeling that what's happening with the American literature, we are doing that to the literature we inherited sort of from the British Empire. And now we're making our revisions, and we're making it more entertaining. So any comments on that?
Quite a revision, and even revising our own history. Thank you, Helen. Elizabeth, what about the revisionist impulse here? I mean, would Mary Shelley have seen herself as revisionist or as a fresh creator?
Well, I think what's delightful here is that the sort of thing that Seth is doing in this novel, the kind of thing that Mary Shelley is doing, because she doesn't invent the Frankenstein story simply. It's part of a whole movement that goes back 30 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What's striking is that to copy something and then go beyond it is simultaneously the most respectful thing to do. It means you admire Austen. It means you admire Lincoln. It means you admire the 1780s and 1790s Gothic novels that Mary Shelley has in mind when she creates her creature. But it also is a way of, if you like, claiming prestige for yourself, claiming that America has something to say, claiming back in the day that Britain had something to say that was distinctive. And so you kind of have your cake and eat it as well. If you lampoon, if you mock something with the wittiness and intelligence that Seth uses, then you do claim your own world and at the same time, you know, tip the hat to your predecessor.
Well, listeners, we report, you decide, as they say in the world these days, whether it's Pride and Prejudice and Zombies or the new book, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. It sounds like there will be some readers, and no doubt we'll hear from them. Elizabeth Richmond Garza at the University of Texas at Austin, it's been a delight having you with us this hour, and we're very grateful for your time and insights. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
And Seth Graham Smith, author of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. We will we'll be watching, sir. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for your reading and thanks for your contributions today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. You can also read an excerpt of Graham Smith's new book at the website there. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Shireen Jafari and Case Wickman. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.